What I have to offer you today is about a five-session seminar that I'm going to try to do in two, and short sessions at that, so don't drop your pencil. There are three verses that I would like to share with you, or short passages, that I think characterize what I have in mind in presenting small group ministry to you. The first one, I think may have been mentioned to you last evening, is in Ephesians chapter 4. And the passage here, you're probably all familiar with it, but beginning at verse 11 of chapter 4, it says, "And his gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors, teachers, for the equipment of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the building up of the body of Christ." And it goes on to describe what the purpose of that building is, to produce a mature individual. And the philosophy that I hold on to as I look at the small group ministry and what it can do and should do in the church's context is that the layman is the man who ought to be doing the ministry, and we ought to help him figure out how to do it. And it's our job to equip him to do the work of the ministry and then let him do it. And a few months ago, quite a few months ago now, a friend of mine and I started to work on tools that we felt could be used by laymen to do a job. And I think for years we've been trying to get the layman to do things that it takes really a rather specialized individual to do. Like if we have some evangelism to do, we try to get him to go out and march down the street and knock on the doors, and it takes the salesman type to do that. Most of us are scared to death when we start that process, and he's petrified. And so that's probably not the most effective tool for the layman. It's good if we have a few of them that do it, and I think it's all right. I'm for going down the street and knocking on doors and getting some people converted this way. But I feel we've got to give the layman some kind of equipment that he can use to do what he can do to contribute to the ministry. And I believe the small group context is something that is usable. And when I'm talking about a small group, I'm talking about, well, if we're going to have a fellowship type of thing, I'm talking about six or eight people. As they gain some confidence and some ability, they might be able to handle larger groups. And we'll talk about another type of small group thing where we might go to 20, 30, 40. But that's getting rather large. Now, another passage that I'd like to share with you in relationship to the small group thing is in Acts 5 and verses 41 and 42. We have here the ministry of the early church. It says, talking of these apostles who had just been before the council, "Then they left the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. And every day in the temple and at home, they did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ." And I think there's a trend going, and I'm in favor of it personally, and that is some ministry in the homes of people. In fact, I believe unless we get to ministering there, that we're not going to be able to do the job in the future. I think all of you, maybe not all of you, some of you probably still have people coming to your doors looking for the answers, but I think today there are very few people who are coming to us to get the message of Christ. And I think we've got to figure out a way to go to them in order to reach them. And I believe the home is one of the very most effective places to reach them. And we'll be getting into some detail on that as we go along here. Then, in relationship to the material we'll be working on in these sessions, in 2 Timothy chapter 2, there is a little passage here about the servant and the ways to operate. And chapter 2, verse 23. And this is the way a leader must operate. It says, "Have nothing to do with stupid, senseless controversies. You know they breed quarrels. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kindly to everyone, an apt teacher, forbearing, correcting his opponent in gentleness. God may perhaps grant that they will repent and come to know the truth, and they may escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him to do his will. And I believe that this is the thing that we're going to try to present in the next couple of sessions, on how to help people utilize this attitude to help people learn in a home situation. Now, I have a lot of material to cover, and there's a lot of things I would like to do with you that I won't be able to do, but I hope that what we'll do as we go along, if you have questions that you would like to ask, I would like to have you feel free to raise your hand and question and talk. Let's make this an informal thing. I find that if you have a question, I'd just as well not be standing here talking anyway, because you're going to think about your question instead of what I'm trying to get across to you, so we just as well stop and get it out of the way. Now, before we turn this machine on, I'm going to be standing right about here, and if you cannot see the screen through me, it would be advisable to move now. What's that? It's not necessary. I think it might be helpful to have lights for you fellows to write by. I think that probably the key reason that a small group is an effective tool is this right here. A small group gets people involved. I don't know whether you men are running into this at all, but I feel it as I get around that laymen are more and more becoming interested in having a piece of the action. Now, maybe some of you look at your layman and you say, if they are, they sure don't look like it. But maybe they're that way because we have made them that way through the years. We've never really depended on them to get involved, and they've kind of gotten themselves to the place where they're out of action. And I'd like to illustrate this involvement thing with one method of spiritual growth that we all recognize. And that is, let's just take getting people into the Bible. Now, I'm sure that you men preach the Word every Sunday and probably several times during the week. And this is a ministry to people. But how much involvement do the people that you're preaching to have in the passage that you're dealing with? Have you watched them much? How many go to sleep on you? I mean, you know that that's a problem. All right. The one who's really gotten involved in the Bible study that's going on in that particular context is you. Because you've done the studying, you've worked, you've labored in the study, you've figured out all those illustrations, and when you get up there, you've got something. But the people have not really gotten involved in it as much as we need to get involved. Now, personally, from my own viewpoint, in my own experience, I think I really got going as a Christian when I got into the Bible for me. And I'm sure that's true of you too. And I'm sure that that's true of our laymen. They're going to get with it when they get into that Bible and it starts doing something for them. Now, how do we do that? How do we get them involved? Well, I've kind of figured this way. If we have a group of, say, 100 people and try to have a Bible study, there's one person involved. That's the leader. Maybe your Sunday school teacher or someone, but it's the leader. If we break that down to a group of, say, 20, and we try to get people involved, we'll probably have 4 or 5 who are really involved. And the rest of them will be sitting there watching. It's like a ping pong match. You know, they'll watch John and they'll watch Dick and they'll, you know, they're the ones that talk all the time, so they just watch. Now, if you bring down to about 6 or 8, you may still have a quiet individual or two, but you can involve everyone. And it's when people start getting involved that they start realizing truths that were there all the time that they've never even seen in another context. And I believe you notice that. I don't know how many of you have ever had some feedback situations, but it scares you sometimes when you get the feedback and find out how little your people know. And get in a small group situation and find out, and then let them start making discoveries for themselves. And this is why I feel a small group thing is really important to us. It does get people involved. And if you don't remember anything else that I say about the small group, this is at least one of the items that I want you to remember. Now, let's spend a little bit of time quickly identifying what a group is. A group is people moving down a pathway of interaction to a goal. And I often feel one of the problems we have is defining a group properly. Maybe I should ask you if your church is a group. Maybe I shouldn't. You know, I was out in Kansas and gave this seminar to a church out there, and some of the people who were involved in it were college students. And I thought that there was this group was trying to start a campus crusade group on their campus, and they asked me to meet with them after the last session and talk to them about what to do. And so there was a group of people there, and so I started asking them a little bit about what they were trying to accomplish. And I discovered that they were not a group, and I identified it for them. I asked them, what do you want to accomplish on that campus? You want to get some action groups. They talked about action groups. I said, do you want these action groups? What do you want them to do? What are you going to accomplish with them? And they sat there and gave me this blank stare. And I said, well, I'm going to tell you something. You're not a group yet, because you have to have a goal out here that you're trying to achieve. You know, we can get collections of people all the time, and amazing, we can get all kinds of interaction. But very seldom do we have this element in it, that the interaction is really headed for something. And when you think of a group, you have to have that goal. In the case of these kids, I said, let me tell you what's going to happen to you. You're going to get together, and you're going to say, well, let's see, what do Christians do? So you'll have Bible study, and that's a fine accomplishment. And you'll have prayer. And then you'll think, well, we ought to have some social events. And I said, before long, you'll be so busy going to meetings and other activities that you have created that you won't even know what you're there to do. So you have to decide ahead of time what you're trying to do. And I think you need to determine with your groups, or a group needs to determine what it's trying to do. If it's a group that's trying to grow spiritually, then they need to determine that. If it's a group that's trying to reach other people and get some evangelism accomplished in it, then that's what its purpose is. But its goal must be decided in order to really have a group. Normally, that goal is determined by all the people in it. However, if you have an evangelistic Bible study, chances are only the Christians in it have that goal. And the others don't really know why they're there, other than they've been invited. Okay, let's move into some types of groups that we will encounter. And this will be quite mechanical, because we have to set up certain procedures in order for a group to work properly. And I'm going to give you those mechanics, and then we'll work from that. First of all, let's just get some ideas of types of groups that we may encounter. The first type of group is one that you encounter every Sunday, and I'm encountering right here. And that's a lecture. And this type of group is a type where an individual has superior knowledge, or is an expert, or something like this, on a particular field, and the people who are sitting in the audience are wanting that information. And this kind of communication is a one-way communication. There's not a two-way thing in here. As I point out, here's the leader, and he is communicating to this audience. And the audience does not really have much participation at all, other than receiving. Now, as you move into a group type of where there's some discussion, you will move into a what could be called a series of conversations. Now, the way this works is that you have a leader here, and he asks the group a question, but that doesn't usually produce anything. So he asks to ask individuals in that group a question, and then they respond back to him. Then he'll ask the next individual, and then they respond back to him. So it's a series that goes on like this. Now, this type of group is one that you will probably see in an evangelistic Bible study. And if you are going, if you as the pastor are going to lead a group in Bible study, you will probably see this the rest of your life. Let me explain that to you. The reason is that you represent an authority figure to the group. You represent an expert. And so when you ask a question, people are a little reluctant to answer, and they're only going to answer when you ask them directly. So you say, John, what do you think? See? And then John gives you his opinion. But he's going to be very careful and guarded as to what he gives you, because he doesn't want to get too far afield from what he knows you want. So he'll be a little reluctant. That's the hazards that you run from your, as you're in your position. Now, I encountered this with a group that I dealt with, college students. I was older than they were. The reason they asked me to lead their group was that they knew I knew more than they did. And, of course, I did know the Bible a lot better than they did. So our, excuse me a minute here, I'm going to have to sneeze. Hope that doesn't last too long. I carried on a series of conversations with this college group for quite some time. In fact, it went on for months. And the way it would work is I'd ask a question, and maybe this individual would give me an answer. Then maybe somebody else in the group would have a question, like Jerry here would have a question. He'd ask me. Okay, I'd throw that question back to the group. Now, let's say that Dick over here has an answer to Jerry's question. How will he answer it? Who will he answer? Yeah, he answered me. You know why he answered to me? It's a sub-psychological thing. He wasn't thinking about it when he did it, but he answers me because he wants to clear his answer with the authority before it goes over here. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been in a group and seen that work, but you watch. It'll work for you. The same thing will happen. Okay, I wasn't able to get away from that until I got out of the dominant leading position of the group. I broke the group down from, there was about 25 people coming. I'd break it down into, say, four groups of six. And I couldn't be in all those six groups, or four groups. I wasn't in any of them. I just said, okay, Rich, you lead this group, and Bob, you lead that group, and I'd give them a set of questions and go work on them. After they had discussed in these small groups and we'd get back together, you know what happened? They'd been in the habit of discussing among themselves, and they forgot I was there. And then if Jerry had a question and Dick had an answer, he'd answer him. And I didn't have to clear the answer. They didn't even see any importance there. Well, the thing that this does, of course, it moves them in a direction toward the last type. And I don't know whether sometimes we would like to get to this one if we're having a real free sharing type of discussion. And that's where we have a true group discussion, where our central idea, we're centered around the Bible. We get the Bible out, and this is what we're really going to talk about. And we depend upon the Holy Spirit to lead us as a group. And then this dotted line here, circle, represents the group as a whole, the personality of the group. And when the leader asks a question, in this case, he asks the whole group. He's not asking an individual. And when people respond, they respond to the group, not particularly to individuals. So you have more of this kind of a discussion going on, where the conversation might go over here, and then back over here, and then over to there, and over to here, and all the way around. So the people make contributions without having to clear through the leader or stop and wonder where he is and what he's thinking. The leader's function in that case is merely to keep the ball rolling. He's like a quarterback. He doesn't do everything, but he helps people figure out what they ought to do. by getting a question in at the right place, picking up the loose ends if there are any, and heading them in the right direction so that they don't get hung up on some detail. Yes?
In a situation, Jerry, like the bottom one, have you found instances where possibly two or more people will take off on a tangent while you as the key figure or the authority figure have been displaced, and people start on their own conversations? Isn't there a hazard of people getting in different, going different directions?
Well, if that happens, of course, it depends on what the rest of the group is doing. Maybe the rest of the group went with them. Is that what you're talking about? Yes.
Or other isolated cases.
Yes. If they do that, you can always bring them back.
And once more, you exert your authority figure again.
Mm-hmm. And the way you bring them back is you just identify what's happened. You say, let's see, I think we've gone off on a tangent here, such and such. That make a good topic for discussion next week, or 2 months from now, depending on what the topic is, and then you come right back to. But let's now. Here's where we were, and take off from there. Now, you have brought up a problem, and I hadn't intended to talk about problems at this stage of the game, but I will. One of the problems you encounter is the dominant type individual who has something to say about everything, and every time there's a question asked, they're the ones that answer it, and that is a problem because you don't get the group involved. That's the purpose of the group, is to get them all involved. And if you have one person that does all the answering, obviously you're not going to go very far with your real purpose. So you have to limit that individual somehow. It's always nice if you can limit him with little activities in the group so that he doesn't realize he's being limited. But if it gets too bad, you have to limit him by sitting him down and talking to him about what you're trying to do and what he's not letting you do, or not letting the group do. He has to realize his responsibility to the group. And if it comes to sitting down and talking to him, I would talk to him on the basis of, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to get everybody involved. And more we like your answers, they're great, but in order to get the other people involved, we've got to let them give answers. Now, another way to limit this person, without him knowing it, of course, is to do things like this. You can bring a timer with you and put a chair out in the middle of the group with a timer on it. Like an egg timer, for instance, one of these little sand fill. That's the best kind, because you can see it in action, you see. And then you say, because of the fact that we want everybody to participate and we're limited with time, we're going to limit everybody's answers to 3 minutes. So you ask a question and your talkative friend starts. You flip the egg timer and the sand trickles through. He answers real fast then because he's got to. And usually, that person who talks all the time can say what he has to say in far less time than he takes. So, at the end of 3 minutes, he's done. Now you can go to somebody else. He realizes that that cut him off a little bit. See, his time is done. Now, what do you think, Mary? And Mary gets a chance to talk, and otherwise she never would have. I think that's a neat little way of doing it. And it's not too offensive. Yes. Yes. And more clearly. Right. Well, let's see. Let's not get too hung up on that problem until we get on a little further. I'd like to discuss another thing about small group mechanics that I think is necessary to get one started on the right step. First of all, you need disciplines in a group. Group disciplines. Now, this doesn't mean laws or some kind of a patrol arrangement, but what we need is enough of a group understanding about what we're there to do and how we're going to do it, so that people feel comfortable. That's the first need. And of course, the first two that we would talk about would be arrangements regarding time and place, really, or the time and physical arrangements. Now, these are important to us for to feel a part of something. Now, all of you came to this conference a few days ago or a day ago. When did this start? Last night, did it? Let's just see if we can remember. When you first came to the gate down here, what were some of the things that you had questions about? What did you want to know?
Where to go.
Okay, where to go? Hmm? Right. What else? Well, you know, I don't know a lot of things. Let's have them.
How beneficial is it going to be to you?
Okay, what are the sessions going to be about? That's
speakers.
Who are they? Where do I stay?
I'm going to go be in a group.
You want more basic things than that too. Where do I eat? And what time? And how often?
How good?
Yeah. Where do I sleep? Right. Okay, why did you want to know all those things? Do you really know? Now, I'm sure that most of you are a little more confident than the average member of a group because you've been in front of, of people for a long time and as a pastor, and you meet the public, and you're more secure than the average individual. But one of the reasons you really want to know those things is that until you know those things, you're insecure. You know, what's going on here? And if you don't know what's going on, no matter what it is, it bothers you. And incidentally, may I suggest that if you're going to start a small group program in your church, because of that very thing, you make sure that everybody in the church knows what you're doing. You know, if you start a small group ministry and you let a half a dozen key people know about it and the rest of them don't, you know what's going to happen? What kind of a subversive thing is going on? You know, you'll have half the congregation bothered because they don't know what's going on, see? But if you tell them, they may not want in on it, but at least they know and they behave themselves, you know, that doesn't bother them anymore. But they do start feeling insecure if they're not in one of those groups. That's kind of the end thing, you see. So there is a security factor, and one of the things we want to do in the small group beginning is to solve that problem. So people need to know where they meet, when they meet, how often they meet, and what's required of them when they get there. Now let's go through some of these possibilities here. In regards to time, it's really a simple thing. You need to know what time each session begins and each session ends. And I suggest that you have both. Don't have one of these open-ended discussions that goes on forever and all night. It will kill a group pretty fast if there isn't a limit and people know how long it's going to last. Not for security reasons in this case, just because they get bored. And the other one is, if you're going to have a series, and I put an if on that because we'll talk a little bit later about having an open-ended type of Bible study that is not a series. But in a case of a series, if you're setting up a series, say, okay, we're going to go for 6 weeks. Let's say you're going for 6 weeks and quit at the end of 6 weeks. Because people do not want to commit themselves to a group forever. I have a friend in town who's done a lot of small group work, and he says that getting out of some small groups is the same way, you get out of some small groups the same way you get out of a life sentence at the penitentiary. You die. That's the only way out. And he talked about a small group of men that met in the morning for breakfast, and they invited him in on it. And he said, how long has this group been going on? They said, 22 years. He says, no thanks. You know, how do you get out of a group like that? Now, I might want out, and I might want out for very good reasons, but the embarrassment and all the rest to get out is too great, so I just endure. And that's no good. And some of you will say, well, if I get one of these things started, I don't want to terminate at the end of 4 weeks, because how will I get it started again? It takes so much to get it started. Well, don't worry. If it's a good group, you don't have any problem. I started one in my neighborhood with the neighbors. We went for, I said, okay, we'll go for 4 weeks. At the end of 4 weeks, I said, well, that's it. They said, what do you mean that's it? I said, well, we said we're going for 4 weeks. And 4 weeks is up. They said, well, we just got started. What are we doing next? See, they won't let you stop if they're really getting something. So you don't have to worry about that part. Now, there's some arrangements that you make physically that I think help us in a group activity, and I think some of these will be helpful suggestions to you or your people. First of all, arrange people in a circle so that they have eye contact with one another. This is why it's so difficult to have a discussion in the sanctuary during Sunday school. the most horrible place in the world to hold a Sunday school class, gentlemen. I dislike it with a passion. The pastor keeps asking me, but to have that one in the sanctuary, and I keep saying, I hate it there. Don't do that to me. But it is. You see, now let's say we're having a discussion here, and one of these fellows back here has something to say. What does that do for you? You know, you kind of, let's see, should I look or shouldn't I? And then if you have a comment or Lee has a comment here, and you fellas back there, all you can do is see the backs of their heads and wonder which one of the backs of these heads is talking. It's really not very conducive to get involved, you see. But if we get in a circle and I can see each other, see, I can carry on a discussion with any one of you because I can see you and you can see me. And that is a very important element to us. You can meet around a table, but you know, these rectangular tables can be a problem too. You know, the third person over is trying to say something, and the only way that you can really see that person is to lean out over, and then the next person down has to lean further. And so it's not so good. Another factor is good lighting. Especially if you're going to be in the Bible, which is what we'd like to do. Let's give people an opportunity to see. In the cases of most of the United States in the winter, it's important to us to start with a cool room. If you're meeting in a home and you're trying to operate with a furnace and all, if you start out at a comfortable temperature, like 72 or so, where most houses are when you start, and you have 15 or 20 people in one room, by an hour's time, it's going to be stuffy and hot in there. So if you can instruct the person whose home you're meeting in to turn the thermostat down about the middle of the afternoon so that that house starts out at 65 or so, when you start your meeting, it's bearable then when you're finished. And it's not that uncomfortable when you start. So that's something to keep in mind. I like the idea of having a Bible for everyone. Now, if we're having a discussion with Christians, that's likely to be an automatic. But if you're having a group where you have some non-Christians, you might want to provide some Bibles so that everyone can have a copy. We'll be getting into this in a little more detail probably next session. But you will see how important it is for people to have a copy and to read it themselves. People learn far more from reading it than they do from hearing it. In fact, if you only depend upon the hearing mechanism, you're operating on about 1/8 of what you can use. If you use the eyesight, you add about a factor of 7 to the intake. And I think we need to think about that one because it's important. We want these people to learn something. Okay, now another thing to try to eliminate is distractions. If there are distractions, they will distract. There's no doubt about it. People will become uninvolved very fast. We had Dr. Hendricks here a few years ago for our staff conference, and he was saying that if he had his way, he would not let any students out of seminary until they've taught a class of 4-year-old kids. And his reasoning was that he says, you know, if you're sitting here in a class of 4-year-olds and a bird lands over there in that tree, that they'll all run over there and look at the bird. Now he says the only difference between 4-year-olds and adults is that they stay seated, but they still went over there to look at the bird. They just didn't let you know it physically. And I think that's true. It's very easy for people to be distracted. So some of the major distractions you might want to eliminate are pets. If you're going to meet in someone's house, you might just find out whether or not they have a parakeet or whatever it may be, because, you know, just about the time you're ready to do some important spiritual business, the old bird starts scratching in the bottom of the cage. Okay, what happens? You know, everybody leaves the subject and goes over to watch the bird scratch, and we're just finished with what we're trying to accomplish. So we want to eliminate that if possible. Another distraction that can cause problems with married families is the kids, the little ones. You know, so my suggestion is to meet later in the evening for these. You know, like 8 or 8:30 after the kids are in bed and asleep and all that. I remember one that we met in a couple's home. Got about halfway through the study, and a little four-year-old girl came traipsing down, you know, on her nightie, right through the middle of the living room. Well, you know what that did? It wiped us out, you know. When we finally got her all back off to bed, we started over again. It's as simple as that. Another one that can distract is food. So I like to put limitations on food. I believe that's a wise thing to do. If you're really going to have a good discussion, I'd suggest leaving the food out of the picture until the end of the session. In the evangelistic study, I think this is important because of the placing of the food. If we have some coffee and cookies or that sort of thing, if we have that right at the conclusion, then people have the opportunity to discuss what they have just come to grips with. And this is often where the business is done, the reaching people. It also is the kind of thing that puts the wives at ease. You know, if you don't put a limit on it, like we're only going to have coffee and cookies, then you're just going to have a contest going on continuously as to who serves the nicest desserts. And every one of these dear wives is going to labor in that crazy kitchen half the afternoon trying to do the best she can for this little event that's occurring. And it's unnecessary. It's unimportant. It's not what we're getting together for. There's really no point in it. And then she's under the strain of serving all this too when the session's going on. So if we keep it simple, you know, we can let that coffee boil by itself. It won't be any problem to us. Yes, sir?
Put the children in the home you're meeting in to bed early, but what about the children of the other?
Well, yeah, that's a problem. If you're going to try to meet and have them there, it's going to be a little difficult, especially if they're little. I find that if you can solve that babysitting problem for them, that's a good thing. Maybe you can get a lady or two in the church to take care of it. That's one way to solve it. I found when I was leading a group, and we had other people coming to our house, which is not necessarily what I'll recommend now, but when we did that, we found that other people were having to get babysitters. So I went to their house and got the babysitter myself, took care of that. Now, you can't do that for everybody. You know, somewhere along the line, they're going to have to take care of their own situation. Any of men have ideas on that?
Most of the time when people go out, they don't, they have their own babysitter anyway, so it's really not a real problem.
It really isn't, no. And we don't have to make as much of it as we might. If we're having an evangelistic study, we may want to take care of this for them just to encourage them to come when they might not. But, yes?
Some of our people have had older children, and it just became part of the discipline as far as parents were concerned to instruct their children. They would be with this older girl in the family room, and they would stay there and play together.
Uh-huh.
And that's worked all
right. Right. And if you run a small group, now, we don't want as many distractions if we can help it. But if you run it without a real rigid attitude about the whole thing, you know, a mother can hear the cry that's going on, know it's hers, you know, and she'll run down there and take care of that, and we can keep right on going. And if the interest is high enough, that distraction can be nullified.
Jerry, sometimes we'll have the Bible study in one location and in a near proximity have another home of a family that's in the church that will take care of all the kids.
Yeah, that's probably the best idea. Yes.
Sometimes food can be used to an advantage in terms of a cup of coffee or something. It's rather relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
We usually have food, and anyone, if they want to get up and have coffee, it's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
They can get up, and it really kind of, especially if they're in an area that's kind of hot for them, they can just get up. It's quite a way to excuse themselves, have a cup of coffee, and then come back and sit down.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't bother them.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. Another one is if you're meeting around a table, to have coffee there on the table when they come, and they can pour when they want to. That's also a solution, very similar to the one you talked about. And I'm not putting forth these ideas as the only way that can be done, because I'm sure that there's about 10,000 different other ideas that'll work. So just there are some principles here that we try to follow. Any other comments or questions you have before we move on to some other material? Well, we're making good progress here. I cut out a lot of material and it's letting me move on. Well, let's talk a little bit. Yes, Jerry, do you have something before we move on?
One thing on the time factor. I think it would it be good to present it as being rigid, but yet leave it somewhat loose once you get in there? Because, in other words, trying not to stop it at a certain point, just for the sake of stopping it, when perhaps that's when this discussion might really be picking up and things really being discussed.
Well, that's always a possibility, but. I think that the benefits derived from leaving it loose as compared to cutting it off probably would not weigh the advantage to cutting it off. What I would do is, if we get to a point where there's obviously some people who want to keep on going, he's come to a termination point, shut it off, and then say, now if some of you would like to continue the discussion, we can do that. This allows the individual who wants to go home and watch the Monday night football game a chance to get out of there. See, he's not going to be with you anyway. And funny, I just happened to be sitting down in the stairs, and my kids had Mayberry RFD on, and they were having a meeting to decide who was going to be the elder. That they needed an elder, and one of them was saying, the football game starts in so many minutes. And I thought, that's so funny because that's so true of so many people that don't say it, And it's that kind of thing, you see, that people have plans. And especially the person who is new, who we're trying to reach. Don't make him stay there two more hours, no matter how interesting it is. Yes.
As part of the initial group discipline, we set a certain time, for example, say 7:39, and they know as part of their commitment that at 9 o'clock comes, they can get up and leave. There's no feeling at all. This is very clearly understood.
Right. And I would stop then. I mean, I would confirm that as a fact by my own actions to cut it off. Because if you don't, then they aren't really free to leave, you see. And that leaves them in a bind.
Yeah. I would imagine that if you continued, even just after you cut it off and let the discussion go too long, it might work a problem too for the people who are hosting.
Yes, that's right. And another thing too about discussion, we'll be getting into some of this here, but lots of times we think what we're doing is, well, this is really vital. But you're far better off to leave a discussion going on its way up to a peak than you are to work the thing half to death and it's on its way to death when you finally quit. And then there's no more thought about it, no more stimulation about it. I'd rather leave that guy going home when I wonder what the answer really is. And make him think about it all week than I would give him some answer that kind of solves it and he shuts his mind off to what we were talking about the rest of the week. So I'm not sure we're really hurting to leave it on a peak and get out of there. Yes?
One other thing about place. So do you recommend you keep it to one certain place rather than moving it around so that there's no question for you going tonight?
Yeah, well, let me discuss two possibilities with you on that. If you're going to have an evangelistic type of Bible study, my suggestion is that you move. Now, that sounds crazy, but I'll explain myself here in a minute. If you're going to have a group of people who are primarily getting together to discuss the Bible for Christian growth, then I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. Except that you do realize that every time you go back to that same home, that wife is going to spend the afternoon of that day or all day kind of putzing around the house cleaning up, because she's going to have company. And it does kind of put a burden on that home, unless it's yours and you don't mind working your wife, But I kind of favor the idea of passing that around. The advantage of moving around is that it becomes their study, not yours. You see, when my neighbors were meeting in my house and I was leading the study, which is a kind of a double mistake, it's my Bible study, not theirs, and I'm dominating the scene because I'm the one who's leading it. And so what I think is more important than what they think. I mean, they're not that it is, but that's what comes across. And as a consequence, the thing has a tendency to die unless they really think you're a great guy. But if you move it Say, Tom, how about having it at your place next week? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, now it's his study, you see. Yes, sir.
Then would you need to kind of get with him a little bit about some of the circumstances and the distractions and so on, and that's a little added work on your part?
It is, but it can be done quite quickly. You say there's some things about this particular meeting that you probably didn't recognize. Well, let me just share a couple of things with you for preparation for next week. And you just tell him, you know, here are some things that we've found that help us. And he'll be able to see that. Yeah, that's right. Now, let me just talk to you a little bit about the idea of evangelistic Bible study that I had the opportunity of getting in on a seminar in Ohio, which I felt filled in a big gap for me in the evangelistic study area. And I think this is the area that many of you would be interested in pursuing. This particular seminar is put on by a church that was started about 10 years ago and is practically all the product of one insurance salesman's Bible studies. And the seminar is taught by men who came to Christ in those studies and who are now leading studies. And if you could see them, you would be impressed as I was. This pastor said in a comment that he made on Sunday morning after we'd gone through the seminar and we're having kind of a sharing time, he said, somebody asked him, you seem to be gone an awful lot from your pulpit. You know, you're going to California and Canada and here and there. Isn't that kind of bad for the people and all? And he said, well, I have anyone of 25 laymen that can fill this pulpit adequately, so I'm really not missed. How about that, huh? How would you like to have that situation? I mean, that's exciting. Well, I think the reason is that those men who've been leading these studies are well qualified. They know what that Bible's all about. It's impressive. I mean, they really know. Well, this church is now a congregation of about 600 people. And that's 10 years. And they have studies going on all the time. And I think they have really figured out the evangelistic Bible study. And here's some of the principles involved in it. One, they do not run it as a church ministry. They won't even tell you which church they're going to. Now, in a smaller town, I imagine some of you are in smaller towns, that's impossible. They all know where you can't. But the pastor himself leads his studies, and he won't even tell them which church he goes to. Because they don't want it that way. They want people to look at these studies as an opportunity to discover what the Bible says. So they want to focus on the Bible. That's all they're doing. Focus on the Bible. Let's talk about three groups of people in that ministry. There's one group called the moderator. And there's another group called the hosts. And then there's another group that we might just call the attending group. All right. I think some of those are quite obvious. The moderator is the one who leads the study. The host is the one who opens their home and lets people come to that place, does the inviting, gets them there, and all that sort of thing, serves the coffee, greets the people at the door, and all that. And then, of course, the attenders are people who are in the process of learning. Now, yes, sir?
Do you mean to say, then, that you seed the group with a few Christians?
Not necessarily, no. You let them come if they have to, you know. Now, that I think brings up another point. I'll try to not get too far astray on that one. But one thing that will kill a group for a group of unsaved people is a bunch of Christians that have all the answers. Now, you'll see that a little more in detail tomorrow when we get into the learning process that people go through. But, well, I had to instruct my fine wife on this point. We started this group in our house, and she can't stand silence. Well, I'd ask a question, you know, and there'd be silence. Lots of it. Deathly type. Well, you know, they don't know who should answer yet, and they're a little timid, and they're afraid maybe they give the wrong answer and all, so you have to wait for answers. Well, I'd give a question, and after this unbearable silence, Kay would answer it, you know. And then I'd ask another question, we'd have some more unbearable silence, and Kay would answer it. And at the end of the study, I said, Kay, you and I had a great study tonight. The only problem is the people who were trying to get involved didn't get involved because we didn't wait long enough. Well, and still worse is the man who's really got all the biblical answers and the jargon to go with it. You know, and he feels obligated to preach his message to this guy he knows needs it, you see. And that's probably the worst way to get the information to him. So we want, we really, for an evangelistic study, if it was the moderator and the host and nobody else who were Christians, you'd probably have the ideal setup. Sir, I know that you have a question there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right. Right. That's the way you do it, too. And you can get the quiet person to contribute. And that's the way you have to get them to contribute. And quite often you can ask the question to the group and then get an individual. You always do it that way, by the way. Don't ask a question, Jim, this, and this in the question, you see. Because then the question is addressed to Jim and the rest of the group shuts off, see. I no longer have any responsibility, so I'll wait and see what Jim does. But if you ask the whole group, then I get the question. And you get the question. And everybody got the question. Oh, I might have to answer that. So I'm kicked into gear, you see. So you want to ask the whole group and then get Mary to contribute. Yes?
Rotating isn't good either, is it?
No. It's pretty dead. There's no life to it. Now, I think you rotate, but you don't let them know you're doing it. You know, you go here, here, there, there, and over here, and there, and you cover them all, you see. But it isn't that, now, it's your turn. That can be death.
Now, do you have any printed material? That would be important.
No, I don't, but I'm going to show you what we do so that you prepare, even though you don't have any printed material. Now you can use printed material. I'm not against that. I sell the stuff over there, see. But and I just packed it all day long. I've got my shipper on vacation. Is this a series?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that's a good thing. Of course, you have to have a pretty good resource man, or you're it. That's right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that those kind of survey things are good every now and then. You might have people that are totally unacquainted with the Bible, and you invite somebody in on a lecture. That's what that is, basically. And there's some good principles that this man is applying, and that is getting the picture, the visualization, the imagination going. All those things are contributing to people learning in that situation. That's good. But I don't think for the average layman it's going to work for him too well.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Uh huh. Yes, I think you may have a comment there before we go on.
I was wanting to ask him how long he ran his series, how this is quite extensive.
Take you about 9 months to get through one a week. For six, that's the first six books.
Do you have two years for twice a month? And it's a year commitment at a time. If they want to go on for 7 years, that's fine. But it's a year commitment.
You want
a year?
Is this for a bank?
No, this wouldn't work out too well. I think book one might work all right for that. Yeah. Establishing people, I think, would be the best for that program. Yes, Pastor Olman.
We didn't get to this, but what about the matter of a pastor or a professional such as you getting unsaved people into such a class?
Okay, that brings me back to where I left my track. Thank you. We have the moderator, we have the host, and we have just the comer, come along. The host is the one who opens their house and so on. The moderator is the one who leads. Now, it's advisable that the moderator not lead in his own home. And there's some very good principal reasons why not. And I've already indicated some. If I'm leading in my house, it's my study and all that sort of thing, you know. And if I invite you to come to my house to listen to my study, then, you know, that's kind of stacking the deck, you might say. But if my friend, who is the host, lives across the town, and they will invite their neighbors in, and they'll introduce me as the moderator, then we run out, then we don't have those problems. You see, if you came to my house to lead a study, and I invited my neighbors in, they might not agree with you. You know, they might run into some little struggles and so on, but they won't hate me, they'll hate you. You see, and you're a long ways away, no problem. And it puts you on the level with them. You see, let's say the pastor that I get to go on going in my house and I invite you to come over to moderate it. All right, when I introduce you to the people, you get there early, so you're there ahead of time. And so here come my neighbors. So I introduce Frank and Tina Sarter to what's your first name? Paul. To Paul Olliman, not Reverend, please. You know, get rid of those titles at this stage of the game. Reverend, no. Paul Olliman. Paul's going to lead the study tonight. Okay, now, Frank and Tina met Paul on the same level. They're both strangers in my house, you see. Okay, then along comes Tom. Peace, see, and I introduced Tom to Paul. All right, that gets away from that professional thing. See, they never even need to know what you do. And in a town this size, that's entirely possible. You can come to my house and lead a study, and they'd never know. Unless they happen to have gone to church down here where just happen to know that. So this is the way that I think you, man, can moderate these things and not really get involved. Now, if you happen to be in a small town, that's impossible. That part, you'll have to get your men to doing this. But now, I don't say any more. I just wait. And I find out that Frank is not busy Tuesday night. Now, if I told him I was going to have a Bible study next Tuesday night and I wonder if he's busy, what is he? He's busy, man. He's busy no matter what the situation is. So you find out whether they're busy or not first. And when it's established, he makes the decision. No, we're not doing anything. Well, I'll tell you what. Kay and I are inviting some of the neighbors to come on over for a little neighborhood get-together. We're inviting a friend of mine to come over and lead a discussion about the Bible, some practical things out of it. And then we're going to have some refreshments and time to visit afterwards. Okay, now there are three things that I've done in there that I want to point out to you. I have, first of all, told them that the other neighbors are going to be involved. That's important. See, if it's just Frank and us and some guy that I get in it, that can be, oops, wait a minute, you see. But the neighbors, oh yeah, he knows the neighbors, you see. He knows, well, you know, if they're in it, I feel like I could probably handle it. So you take a little fear away from him, what he might be getting into. He's not coming to a Bible study, number two. He's coming to a Bible discussion. Now there's a difference in the term that you use there. A Bible study means work and means you might need to know something. A Bible discussion means that I'm ready right now because I don't need to know anything to discuss it. And that's pretty important too. Because the individual who doesn't know anything about the Bible doesn't want to be invited to a Bible study. And the other thing is that we're going to have refreshments, and this looks like it might be a nice social evening as well. You see. And it will be. And I think that's those are some factors which will help. Now, you know, it's interesting to me to listen to these people. There are a couple of pastors in this seminar with us. And they ask, you know, I'm going to go back to my people and I'm going to try to get this started. Where do I start? Who does the inviting? You know what they said? The people that we use for hosts are the youngest Christians in the congregation. Guy's been saved a week. He said the reason is that by the time a person's been a Christian for 10 years, he's lost all contact of any significance with the people that need the Lord that they can invite. That's sad, but it's true. And so I think that you just have to face up to it that probably the best candidate to invite people to their home are the people that have just come to Christ. They know all those people that don't know the Lord. And it's kind of fun to watch them invite them. I mean, I have a friend who says, if you want to get something done, ask a heathen to do it. He doesn't know it can't happen. You know? You know, if you want to get a guy to round up somebody for Bible study, you know he asks? Get some non-Christian that's interested. He'll do it. Down here at Colorado College is one of the worst places we've ever found a minister. And I ran into a guy that was kind of interested because he met this girl that was working at the same place he was working, down at Continental Airlines. And he got kind of curious about Bible study and, you know, what's this Bible thing all about, because he observed this girl. And so she introduced him to me one conference we had out here, and said he was interested in Bible study, and I couldn't really figure out for sure where do we start. I didn't know. She didn't tell me anything about the guy. You know, just brought him up, and here's Joe, and that was it. See, and so I had to do this little research project to try to figure out what I had, whether Joe was what he was, you know, Christian, non-Christian. Well, I discerned pretty fast that Joe didn't have the faintest idea what he wanted. But I told him, well, he thought maybe he could get into a study I was already having, or something like this. So I said, well, Joe, we usually try to design a study for the people that are in it. You know, we'd like to design one that you would like to be in, for you. Oh, really? Yeah. He said, could my friends come do it? I said, well, yeah. How many friends you thinking about? Oh, I think I could round up 20. You know, it'd take us 400 years to round up 20 people for Bible study over there. But he'll do it just like that, see? So I think we have to find the person who is not too far removed from the people we're trying to reach and get them to do the inviting. Okay, now we get him invited. Now, we get there, we have this study. To keep it going places, let's say that a person who lives two doors down from the host is there and they like it. During the coffee break, we find out they really like that study. What do you do? You say, would you like to have it at your house next week? Now, here's what it does for you. You go two doors down and say, now, by the way, as long as you're having it at your house, you might have some friends that you would like to invite. Okay, they invite people that you would never reach if you kept working at it for the next 20 years. Because they'll bring somebody, you know, from clear across town that they work with that's interested in this stuff. Okay, that guy across town may be your next candidate to get your second study going, only one over there instead of here. You see, this thing can...
Are you talking about the same study, the same group?
No, I'm talking about going after the people who don't know Christ, you see. We've got to keep after them, you know, keep pushing on doors. We may keep a study in this neighborhood and start one over there. Only it's Wednesday night over there instead of Tuesday here, you see. Or a new moderator, maybe. But... You had a comment.
Yes, this was back with the other matter of inviting them. I didn't remember you saying that you would be introducing, you'd be having a leader when you're calling this fellow on the phone, his neighbor here.
Yeah.
Inasmuch as you are who you are, of course, that would make it different than a new convert. But he would be inclined to think, has Jerry been yet?
Yes, he would.
Did you say that?
Yeah, I did say that, but I may not have made it quite clear. I would say in the conversation that we're inviting a friend of ours to come over and lead the discussion so that he knows there's somebody else involved in it. Yes?
I'm
just wondering, as a pastor, it isn't that we don't want them in our home as we go to different homes, but it isn't our home, really, you know, the rest of the congregation. I wonder what their reaction would be if they meet in the parsonage.
Well, yeah. Are you concerned now about your people meeting there, or just the unsaved people?
I wonder what the congregation, the rest of the congregation, the biggest portion that doesn't come at all.
Oh, what they're going to think?
What their reaction would be to inviting them to the church's home. Now,
well, that is a problem. Depending on where you are and what your people are like and all, I think it's a sad problem, but it's still a problem we have to face. It's people are people. That's the whole thing, you know. Mankind I love, it's people I hate, you know. You had a comment from someone here.
Are people almost as afraid of the parsonage as they are of the church itself?
I think they are. I think that really worries them. Now, I don't know. You know, we all in the same boat. Is professional Christians. They look at us like we're something different. And it's just one of those hazards of being in that business, I guess. Now, I think that you can help them by letting them know how ordinary you really are. You know, let them into your life a little bit and let them know that you have the same problems they have. I think that may be one of the things that we need to do a little bit more of in our ministry. Is let them know. You know, it's kind of hard to go air all of your dirty wash before your congregation, and I'm not suggesting that, but I think, every now and then let them know that you have a problem. You know, then problems don't just end when you get ordained, you know. They just started. Many of the problems just started there. Yeah. Okay, well, any other questions or comments you have? Let's see here. We've got about 15 minutes. Let me introduce you to the idea of what the leader's function really is, and tomorrow we'll get into that and really dive after it.
Yes. Off on evangelistic
Bible study. Well, yes. My feeling, yes and no. I'm jumping back here. What the leader does, no matter what kind of a group you're in now, will be the same.
But tomorrow you're going to come back to some specifics.
I'll be coming back to this particular technique on evangelistic Bible studies. Yeah, it's Thursday. It's Thursday what? Morning? It will, right? You better get me straightened around because I might miss it if I don't. It's tomorrow? I'm glad you pointed that out. I thought it was Thursday. Let me see that schedule.
It was Wednesday morning.
Did they change it?
That was Plan A.
Plan B.
Plan B.
In other words, this is no good anymore.
This is the one we're going.
Oh, this is the one. Oh, they sent me one of these, but I was gearing into that Thursday morning thing. Boy, glad you. What hour is that? I'll be here. Okay, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Yes, thank you. Well, getting to the evangelistic study, I feel that the evangelistic study is the thing that really makes this go. Now, you can use the same techniques with the Christian group. And the same principles and group dynamics and all the rest work for them too. The thing is, when you're dealing with a non-Christian, you're dealing with a man who is less likely to understand what you're dealing with than the Christian is. And if you can handle him, you can handle anybody. That's the way I've got it figured. So I'll probably concentrate more of the concepts around the evangelistic thing. Okay? I have a study plan, which I'll give you, and the way you prepare to lead one of these studies. You can pick any topic in the world if you want. Okay? That's I think, the thing that bothers everybody is, what do I use? Yes, all right.
Is the evangelistic study also a part of this series of, say, 4 weeks we're going to get together?
No.
No.
The evangelistic study that I'm going to suggest to you is an open-ended thing. And for the reason that I think you alluded to there. Now, wait a minute. What study are we talking about? See, if I go from this house to that house, and I'm going week after week after week, you know, now what happens here? Does this guy follow along each week? And do we get a new topic for him every week? And how do we handle that? That is the problem with an evangelistic study, because you have to get the gospel in all the time. and you have the same people coming along. And that looks like a problem. But the results that I saw from this group that's doing it, I'm not so worried about it anymore. Because you can take any topic and get the gospel into it. And you can edify the saints that are there. At the same time, you can lay the good word on the people who need that good message. So I think, I don't think it's a problem. I think you can kind of combine them both. Yes?
And then some of the ones that are coming to Christ maybe can get into another one that's unique for them.
But you know, I'm convinced of something. I'd like to keep them out there in the front line where it's really happening and people are coming to Christ. I mean, we want them to grow and develop, you know, and all this other thing. But I think that they develop faster when they're right out there in the middle of where all this is happening. You know, that $64,000 question in your ears, there cannot be a better stimulus to learn. You know, what do you do when they ask that? Okay, you know.
Let's go back to, you had one in your home and you invite
Paul's going to lead it? Okay.
And I come in and you introduce me to Paul. Well, one of the first things we're going to do is say, well, what do you do, Paul? Once I know he's a man of the cloth, I'm
going to
hear.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't want you to be a liar. I don't want him to be a liar for my sake, but he can say, I work on the other side of town. What do you do?
I mean, you were talking...
I work on the other side of town. What do you do?
Yeah.
Well, pat that butt, quick.
You're putting yourself in our category, and yet you can travel incognito as a navigator. Well, yeah, I mean, what's that, you know?
Yeah, well... I'm not so sure. I've got just as much of a problem or worse. Because I've got to explain this much. Oh, I hate that. You know, it's terrible to have to go someplace and have a navigator. What's that? You know, good grief. Well, it's, yeah. Every now and then you have to present the gospel to people because they ask that, though.
Well, I guess you could say from Colorado Springs.
Well, I can. I can tell them I'm an office manager and an organization. But it is a problem to us, you know, and I'm not saying you're going to solve it. I think it was interesting to listen to this pastor out in Ohio explain his problem. Yeah, what happened is that he got in a meeting with one of his men, and he was leading the study. And this lady in the group, she kept trying to get him to tell what he did, you know. I do the same thing this guy does, you know, and leading studies. Well, what does he do? He does the same thing I do. He never did tell her because he figured it'd kill the whole thing.
Why does he feel it would kill the whole thing? Because you're on a preacher or something?
Well, no, the thing is this, that if you're dealing with, if you knew this particular case, I think this lady was a Jewish lady and she was kind of anti-Bible and a few other things, you know, and she was trying to get at something. And if he had identified himself, then it had blown the whole thing for him. And so he just wouldn't. Yeah.
I conducted this last year a number of Bible studies, and most of the people that attend are not involved in our church. They're Catholics, Divine Science, everything. I make no bones about who I am or the church I'm going to. I mean, we don't say much,
right,
but they just know.
Well, I think that your own attitude and the way you convey yourself to that group is probably has more to do with it than the fact that you're a pastor. And that, I think, is something we all need to learn more about. And let me just give you an illustration that we bumped into. The first seminar that this friend of mine and I ran was up in Spokane, and he had been there as a representative of the Navigators. And he, of course, had friends in the neighborhood. And across the street from where he lived was a Roman Catholic family. And so he just said, let's go out and visit him while we're here. So we did, and she wanted to know what in the world we were doing in Spokane, and so we started to describe what we were doing about the seminar and small groups and all. She said, oh, we have something like that. And the Roman Catholic Church has something they call a Christian home family movement or something like this, and it's a discussion type of thing. And she said, oh, yeah, well, we have something like that. And she started to describe the effect that the various priests had had on this group. The first priest they had that started it, he was all for it, you know, and very positive and had the good attitude toward the people responding. The second man spent most of his time ill, so he didn't do too much. But the last one, she said, he's killing it. And then she started to describe what he was doing. And he was taking the authority position. If somebody gave an answer and it was this far off from, you know, the answer he would give, then he'd have to give a theological discourse on, you know, what that truth was. and it would kill it. She says, "Boy, nobody's going to say anything in that situation." Well, that's the thing we all have to remember, is if we're going to, you know, come and pound on them with our truth, and we do know more than they do, no doubt, but we've got to put ourselves across some way so that it doesn't come out that way. And I think you're doing that with that group. If we could set in on it, I think we would realize that. And you solve part of the problem by the way you convey yourself. Yeah. Yes, sir?
We had nice discussions, and then someone will say, "Well, what does the pastor think about this?" You know, we may know more, but what would you do in that case?
If, you know, what's the context that we're in?
Well, it doesn't make a difference what subject.
Uh-huh.
They're discussing four or five that contributed.
Okay. Yes. Okay, now let me just share with you one more thing that this group of people do that I think will help you with that. They are very clear about one thing, and that is that we're going to find out what the Bible says. And it doesn't make any difference what my opinion is, or what yours is, or anybody else's. We want to find out what the Bible says about this. And I believe right here is a big key. This is one of the reasons maybe you're getting along so well with that group of people. They want to know what the Bible says, and they know you're going to take them there. But if you will take them and say, "Okay, now," they said, "Well, what does the pastor think about this?" Well, let's turn over here to, you know, Romans chapter 3. And let's see, everybody get it? You wait while they open it up, and you say, let's see, will you read the first 14 verses of chapter 3 there? Okay, now, what do you think that... I think the third verse here, there's a little that statement made. What do you think about that? See, what you're going to do is you're going to open that Bible up and you're going to get them in it. And you have really solved the problem. You know, you're back to what the Bible says, not what the pastor thinks.
Yeah, Billy Graham. That's
the word. Yeah, well, we got to get them in the Bible. That's where it is, yeah. Because as soon as we start giving opinions, see, even though you're right... Your opinion is right from the Bible and all. They have a right to disagree with you. And they have grounds to start feeling like maybe they ought to. Yeah, well, my church teaches. Well, fine, you know, but if you say we're going to talk about what the Bible says, it doesn't make any difference what your church teaches. Which is where we are in a lot of these studies. Like, you have a group of people and they probably have some ideas about what their church teaches. I'm amazed, though, when you get them in, when you say, "Okay, we're going to talk about what the Bible says," how much fun it is and how positive they are. I had the privilege last year leading a Bible study out of the convent out here, which totally surprised me when I started the thing. And it was very interesting. And it took us forever to get around to any issues that I thought we should run into anyway. But we got to, Mary being sinless one time, and I said... Well, you know, I don't really think that was necessary in the theology of Christ being sinless for her to be sinless, and I don't think the Bible says that. And one of them says, "That's right, it doesn't." Hello, that's right. Boy, we had good, honest discussions. It doesn't say that. It's just that we think that's the way it was. It's kind of part of our tradition. Fine. Well, let's see, we're at 2:55 now. Let me kick your thought processes into gear on one thing for tomorrow, and this is what we'll major on. The leader's function is to get people involved. Now, you remember the small group, its strength is to get people involved. Now, the leader of the small group, his job is to get the people involved. He needs to concentrate all his thinking on them. How do I get them involved? That takes a lot of pressure off in one way. I don't have to come to my study all ready to preach, you know, and like I've worked for 8 hours on a sermon and all that. I just get away from that. My job is to get these people involved in the truth right here. And is it ever fun? You know, it's enjoyable to get people involved and hear them come out with answers that you didn't think they could ever figure out, you know, and all that. But to get them involved, that's what we're going to do. Now, I got one more sheet for us, since we've got a minute or two here. Hope I can find that sheet.
tragedy.
Jerry?
Yes, sir.
I think one of the key vitamins term is the moderator. And that leads to the idea of the teacher being present in our group.
Right. There's no teacher, no authority, no expert. And but the expert is the Bible. The truth is here. And we're going to get in there to find out what it says. That's the key. Then we're no longer having to come with any, you know, great truth. And I think for laymen, now you men aren't in this position very often. You're probably in it more often than you admit, but you've probably learned through the years you can't be in this position. But for laymen, their big fear is they're going to get into some place where they don't have the answer. What do I do if they ask a question I can't answer? You know what they do? They say, I don't know. You know, it's the best answer you can give if you don't know. But most people figure they're, and most of us feel obligated because of what the position we have, that we've got to come up with an answer whether we know or not. So we make up something, you know, real quick to fill the air. No, you're better off to admit you don't know, and that, you know what? The people will love you. The reason they love you is they think, you know, he's not totally perfect after all. He's human. He's just like me, you know. Maybe I can get along with him. Well, here's some things that I think we ought to just kick our minds when we're trying to help them get involved. Really, we're trying to help them make discoveries. And we do this by basically two means. By asking questions instead of giving answers. Now, asking questions does a couple of things. One is it helps them think. See, that's what we're trying to do. Make them think. So when we ask a question, they have to think. And it lets them do the talking. Now, this is very important in the learning process. If you ask me a question and I have to give an answer, and I do give an answer, that means that I really did have an answer for that question. But how many times have you thought you knew the answer, and then when somebody asked you, you had a terrible time trying to give it? Ever happened to you? I hope it has, because it's pretty human that it happens. You know why that happened? We had some impressions, but we hadn't thought through our answer far enough to really know whether we understood it. Okay, when people have to give the answers and they do the talking, that's what they're doing. They're hammering out the conclusion for themselves. And if you get an unsaved person to give the answer to the key question, you know what that does for him? Boy, that nails it down tighter than if you preached and pounded on the pulpit for 100 years. Because, I'll just give you an example. My friend Russ Johnston was in a meeting. This unsaved girl got in this group where we were having seminars on how to lead people to Christ. And she was in his group. And he said, he was starting to present how you would help a person understand that they were a sinner and needed help, you know. And he said, okay, here's the way we do this. And he opened up Romans 3:23 and he says, okay, somebody read it. You know, he had him read it. He said, now what does that mean about you and me? You know what her reaction was? Her mouth fell open, you know. Like this is, you don't mean everybody's a sinner, do you? When she said that, you know, that clanged bells all the way for her. That was the first time in her life she ever knew that. She became a Christian that night. Because Russ went through the whole thing and then got a couple of girls and stick them, you know. Go see that girl. She needs something. And she came to Christ. But I think it was the fact that she gave that answer that made a big difference. Okay, now, another thing that helps us in this, helping them make discoveries, is your attitude. We've talked about this briefly already, in relationship to our being a pastor and leading a discussion. But the attitudes that you have toward various facets here. First of all, toward their questions. It's pretty critical how we feel, what we put across as a feeling toward their questions. Because, you know, every now and then they're going to disagree with you and they'll ask a question that we indicate that has a little barb in it. You know, I don't really agree with you type of question. Okay, your response to that question is going to be pretty important to the whole group. Because if your response at that particular point is to defend yourself, you're going to announce to the whole group, boy, don't ask him any questions unless, you know, you're on the good side of it. See, but you want to take that, the attitude that you want to have toward that kind of a question is, I must not have been very clear in what I said. They misunderstood it. And that's an honest question to learn something. You don't go around spending your life defending yourself. Your job is to help them learn, see. So have the right attitude toward their questions. Accept them. Another is toward their answers. And here we got a little bigger problem. What do you do if they give the wrong one? Well, first of all, you have to accept their answers as an honest attempt on their part to answer as best they could. And after all, that's what they thought. Now, it doesn't make them right. And if you have the wrong answer, the thing to do, that's interesting. Now, let's see, anybody else have any ideas on that? Or Joe, what do you think? See, chances are that whoever else is in the group is going to give the right answer, right? And the person who gave the wrong answer does not have to be crucified for doing so. Just ignore the fact that they are there now. See, if I have to pay a price for giving a wrong answer, how many answers am I going to give? None. And you know what kind of a group I'll have? You know, you wonder why every 14th question gets an answer. And 13 don't. The reason is, they aren't sure of themselves to give you an answer, so they're not going to. And you'll have a group that doesn't discuss a thing. So you have to accept wrong answers. But you don't necessarily stop there. Now, you can, let's say that you keep asking other people and you keep getting wrong answers. Now, there's another conclusion that you come to. You got a lousy question. Because if you can't get the right answer to the question you're using, you better change questions. Or you don't have adequate reference material. Change your question and take them to another part of the Bible and see if we can't get it figured out. See, now, what does this give us any clue?
How would you do that after you got your third wrong answer? You said, well, let me ask it this way.
Uh-huh. That's one way you could do it. Let me rephrase that question, or let me ask it this way. And the other thing you could do is say, okay, now we've got an idea here from this particular verse and this question. Let's go over here and look at another passage. So we go over to John 14:36 or whatever it is, see, and say, now, okay, would you read that, you know, and you read it, and we just start discussing. Now, does this give us any light on that question we had? You see, we can draw that in there. Dick?
It keeps from appearing to say that somebody's given a wrong answer. I think it's also important not to non-approval every time you get a right answer, isn't it? Otherwise, see, they just know you don't nod, you know, you don't agree.
Yes, I think you're tipping you might be tipping your hand a little bit there. Although there is the principle of encouraging people when they give the right answer, that encourages everybody. You just have to watch it. I think you got a point there. Nellie?
I think one thing one has to really be careful of is that when people think that you have a particular answer in your mind and you're having a guessing game until they find your answer. And I think when you say, well, maybe I didn't word that right, then you say, what you're really saying is they haven't answered the way you want an answer.
Yes, or you could be asking a question that is too ambiguous, you know. Nobody could answer it unless they could get inside your mind and figure out what you were thinking. I do that quite often. And I just have to admit that I got a lousy question.
It's almost better to leave you temporarily with the wrong concept about the thing, and eventually, through the whole study, that you get the right concept, than to push this thing till they come to your conclusion.
Yes, and about your own conclusion, there's another problem there. Don't accept answers that are in the ballpark. And lots of us try to get them to give our answers, and you never do it. Let's see. Okay.
Would it be proper to say, in addition to what was said, comments,
Right.
It would lead up eventually to that.
Right. Well, let me give you that last little statement there, and then I think we better quit for today, and we'll carry on this discussion tomorrow. One of the things about your attitude, if you're open and honest about your life, this is going to help a whole lot. if you want them to be open and honest and really get down to nitty-gritty, the way to do that is to be that way yourself. And we'll leave that with you for tomorrow. We'll come back to this. I think what we'll do is review this sheet that we've just gone over here, and then we'll pick up the discussion from there, because I think we may have some items that we want to talk about. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer together, and we'll conclude. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be together, and I pray as we think about these mechanical aspects of leading a group and getting involved with people and getting some of our people involved, that you'll lead us and give us the ideas we need for our particular situation. And we commit these sessions to you, and what we learn, that we'll use what is helpful to us and what you have in mind for us to use. In Jesus' name, amen.